The origins of the Great Sphinx of Egypt has been the subject of debate for a very long time, at least since Napoleon's men rediscovered the site. But the tone of that conversation changed drastically in 1990, and with his expedition and the subsequent publication of his paper in 1992, where geologist Robert Schock claimed that these marks are water erosion marks, and that there hasn't been enough rainwater falling in that area since around 12,000 years ago, during the time of the Green Sahara, to create that erosion. Ergo, this pit was dug around 12,000 years ago. That's Robert Schock's basic position. Now, this, of course, was met with a lot of skepticism, and probably the best argument against it, in my opinion, is that water wicks up from the ground, like rainwater, groundwater would wick up from the ground, and then during the morning time, it can form dew and stuff, and this could run down. It's more complicated than that, and we'll discuss in a minute, but basically that's not rainwater that's created these erosion marks, but it's water come up from the ground. Now, there's another thing that's recently come up. It's actually come up quite a long time ago, but it's only recently come up to me, thanks to my friend Matt over at Ancient Architects. He recently posted a video that when I watched it, I was like, well, hot damn, I wonder how come I hadn't heard of this before. There's another geologist that's been weighing in on this, and his work has been, it's less fantastic. He doesn't go into 12,000 years ago, or Robert Schock now even goes further back in time. But this guy, his name is Colin Reeder. I knew I could remember it without looking at the screen. Colin Reeder, and he is a geologist, and he has some pretty interesting stuff based on water erosion patterns inside the Sphinx enclosure, and I dare say it's more nuanced than what anything that I've seen before. So let's take a look at this, and instead of arguing with people, we'll talk about big rocks and cool shit for a change. Hi, my name's Dan, and welcome to Dedunking. The idea of the Sphinx is older than the 4th dynasty, is almost as old as the field of Egyptology itself. Sir Flinders Petrie stated it was basically pointless to challenge the idea that the Sphinx was made by Khafre, but just a few years later, a French Egyptologist, Gaston Maspero, challenged this, claiming the fact that the Sphinx had Khafre mentioned in the Dream Stela, which describes the work done on the site to refurbish it in ancient times, was evidence that it was old in Khafre's day. Maspero believed, as others have since, that Khafre is not credited with the creation of the Sphinx in the Stela, but instead was credited with excavating and refurbishing the Sphinx. Maspero claimed that the Sphinx was the most ancient edifice in all of Egypt, and he believed that if it was further excavated, they would find a pedestal like most of the little statues that you see have the Sphinx resting on. Now, he did believe in buried treasure and secret underground passages and stuff, so he's the kind of guy nowadays Egyptologists would wag their finger at. However, he was the first person to methodically and scientifically, in any meaningful sense, excavate that Sphinx enclosure. And he did a lot of really good work there. And in fact, his observation regarding the Dream Stela and Khafre not being the creator of the site, but the excavator and refurbisher of the site, is something that has influenced a number of people over the years, convinced a number of people, myself included, that it's most likely that is the case. And that's going to be important as we go forward. E.J. Wallace Budge was the next Egyptologist to carry the torch of an older Sphinx, stating, "This marvelous object, the Great Sphinx, was in existence in the days of Khafre, or Khafrefrin, and was probably a very great deal older than his reign, and that it dates from the end of the Archaic period around 2686 B.C. And, of course, most of you are aware of the work done by Robert Schock that I mentioned in the intro, John Anthony West, and R.A. Schwaller de Lubitsch, claiming the Sphinx was made about 12,000 years ago in 10,500 B.C. This was based on both archaeoastronomy and geology, and we will touch on the archaeoastronomy before the video is done, because I just love that shit way too much to not talk about it. But before we get going, we should really talk about the hard data first, the true science here, and that's the field of geology. And again, this is really going to come down to erosion patterns. As most who have researched this site are forced to admit, the geology is inconclusive, at least as far as pinning down a date of construction goes. There certainly are clear signs of water erosion, and it does look like there was a lot of water carving the channels in the limestone. Now, the work of Robert Schock was criticized immediately, with geologist K.L. Gari making the case for groundwater seeping up and the stone being exfoliated, in different amounts based on the hardness of the bedrock. This work was revisited in 2014 when Dr. Robert Schneiker published a paper discussing the possibility of groundwater wicking up to the surface. the water dissolving some of the limestone and creating salt crystals. And when the water evaporates, the salt crystals then, having seeped further down into the stone, created smaller fissures and slowly, over time, exfoliated the rock, creating little flakes that fell off. Now, Robert is currently working on publishing a paper with Dr. David Miano, somebody most of you need no introduction to. And this paper is going to be discussing the Sphinx, and most likely, from what I've seen from David talking about, we're looking at, like, them talking about them covering the Sphinx with bricks over the years and all of that stuff. Interesting ideas, however, I do think it's worth pointing out that Dr. Robert Schnaicher did not come into this with a kind of an open mind or a clear slate. Here, I'll let him explain it himself.
What about this specific argument sort of the weathering and the erosion drew you in to speak up and do some research?
Wow, that's a good question. I'm not so sure it was the weathering or the erosion. It was the realization that the archaeologists, the Egyptologists, probably know what they're talking about and that it isn't older. And if you're going to instantly, as Robert Schock has, instantly jump to saying it was a lost civilization, I sort of felt like I was a doctor coming on an accident scene and I needed to do what I could. So I think that probably more than anything explains why I started looking into it.
So I do have to take his work basically the same as I would take the work of somebody who was like, aha, I believe the Sphinx is 12,000 years old. Then they go to Egypt and find evidence for it with a grain of salt, right? You didn't come into this with a clean slate of ideas. You went looking for something and found it. That's not exactly the most robust bits of science. That's definitely going to need some verification, right? And there's a lot of debate about it. And in all honesty, the geology, it seems to me, isn't well explained by any one of these ideas. The groundwater wicking and exfoliation of the rock, pieces of it flaking off, does not explain those channels in it. It does explain the waves, right? So it does seem like neither one of these hypotheses, Robert Schock's or Robert Schnaicher's, is really complete. But the work of Colin Reeder, surprisingly, well, it seems that most people have based the ideas on the Sphinx has been renovated numerous times, but the Sphinx enclosure has been left alone, hasn't been touched this whole time. And Colin Reeder asks the question, "If what if that's not true?" And then he finds evidence for it. Let's see if his holds up. Now, Colin is an engineering geologist with 25 years of experience who dabbles in Egyptology. He has made some noteworthy observations regarding the Sphinx enclosure, one of them being the erosion pattern is not distributed evenly, but it's concentrated in certain areas more than others. He also noticed that there's a clear section on the north wall of the enclosure that shows that the wall itself was the subject of partial renovations. He highlights what he refers to as 4th dynasty cutting in the enclosure and points out the more weathered appearance of the stone next to the end of the 4th dynasty cutting area. He argues that this demonstrates that the site was already old in the 4th dynasty and was renovated then, not originally made then. And if you look, there is a clear demarcation line between the point that he calls the 4th dynasty cutting area and the older area. As a matter of fact, it's so easy to see that he made his case in black and white, literally, like in 2002 he published his paper, and he was using images like this, because I guess that was all he could publish in it or whatever, but it was still very easy to see what he's talking about here. Now, that's pretty interesting if you think about it, but it's not the only thing that he brings to bear when he talks about this. Colin cites several reasons that he believes the area of the Giza Plateau surrounding the Sphinx was built on as a ceremonial center long before the 4th dynasty. There is more than one structure that he mentions that looked to have been changed over time, but his evidence mostly consists of the effects of water runoff in the immediate vicinity and the different types of erosion present in different quarries and pits, including the Sphinx enclosure. He proposes a timeline for the Sphinx and Sphinx Temple based on the erosion of the northern wall of the enclosure. He says, A. The construction of the Sphinx and the first phase of the Sphinx Temple took place before Khufu quarried the site, during an era when the exposed limestone was subject to periodic erosion by surface runoff. B. The Sphinx Temple was subsequently incorporated into Khafre's 4th Dynasty mortuary complex, at which time it underwent a second phase of construction when modifications were made to the northern and southern walls of the temple, together with limited quarrying of the Member 1's limestones to the immediate north. C. Because these modifications took place after Khufu's quarrying of the plateau, the newly exposed member 1 limestone were not subject to erosion by rainfall runoff and therefore do not show the same pattern of intense degradation which is apparent elsewhere within the Sphinx enclosure. Now, he's painstakingly mapped out the region's drainage, and he is of the opinion that the Sphinx may well be a pre-dynastic site. And one of the key pieces of evidence that he uses for this is the fact that there is a quarry that's to the west of the Sphinx that was put there during Khufu's time. In 1843, Egyptologist Carl Lepsius was on the Giza Plateau and witnessed a flash flood with water severe enough to move iron crowbars and sweep them away. Lepsius described the water forming a lake to the west of the Sphinx, and the small lake had no outlet, implying that the waters never reached the Sphinx, as the western area is uphill from the Sphinx. The most likely candidate for this place that made the lake was a quarry to the west of the Sphinx. This quarry was made by Khufu, Khafre's father. This is significant because the western side of the Sphinx enclosure has the heaviest signs of actual water erosion, not the exfoliation, but the water lines coming right down the side of the rock. And this is something you see on the side with the hill that would have the runoff, big shock there. So the western side and the north and southwestern portions have the heaviest signs of this runoff. Now we have a pit there. Since Khufu's time, there's been a pit there that fills with water now when these flash floods happen. Now, they were probably more common in Khufu's time for them to have these flash floods than they are now. But you go all the way back into the Green Sahara, and they were probably like the era shortly after the Green Sahara. They were probably extremely common, right? And we see signs of rainwater erosion on the side of the Sphinx enclosure that's coming down the hill, the western side. But now there's something that stops that water from reaching the Sphinx enclosure. But it's not from now. It's from Khufu, from Khafre's father. And this is what Colin Reader, argues is the evidence for the Sphinx enclosure being older than the Khafre and Khufu. There's clear evidence of water erosion coming down that hill, but there's a pit now that would stop that from happening. So this is pretty good evidence, actually, when you look at it. It doesn't go back as far as, his evidence isn't pushing it back necessarily as far as geologist Robert Schuck, but it definitely, that's a solid argument, very logical, very based in reality, and it's kind of a smoking gun there. I mean, it's like you have to have a lot of water to overflow that pit and to run down into the Sphinx enclosure. Now, he makes a really good case, and I've linked the papers on the matter below. Ultimately, he believes that this evidence points to a pre-dynastic sun cult using the outcrop of rock that was eventually carved into the Sphinx for a few centuries, maybe 1,000 years or so before the Fourth Dynasty. Now, I believe that this shows us a pattern that goes even further back in time. I believe that water being included in the enclosure was actually part of the reason that the enclosure was made. And this opinion is informed by Egyptian mythology. It's not just something I dreamt up like Edgar Cayce. Now, the Egyptians had several different creation myths, but one almost ubiquitous feature of these stories was the inclusion of the primeval mound, the first mound of earth that poked through the waters at the beginning of creation. This is an idea that's emulated in the major pyramids. We see that almost all of them have a mound of bedrock inside the center of the foundation that is said to emulate that primeval mound. The Benben stone itself, which is said to be the original pyramidion, aka the top of a pyramid, was associated with this primeval mound. The idea of a piece of earth emerging through the original primeval flood waters and as being the start of creation was something the Egyptians seem to have been obsessed with and kept in their mythology for a very long time, and it was attached to their notions of the rebirth of the soul. And I think this goes very far back. If you were to go to the area where the Sphinx is during the time of the Green Sahara and assume that it was not dug at the time, that it was just a flat piece of land with an outcrop of rock, 10,000, 12,000 years ago, you could wade up to that. There would be, depending on what time of year, it might be ankle deep, it might be waist deep, it might be shoulder deep. Depends on who you look at. But from the stuff that I've seen, it's all accessible by humans. They could have walked to this outcrop of rock sticking up out of the water. The fact that that outcrop of rock is situated naturally to align itself to the rising sun on the spring equinox, so it's facing due east, it may well have been significant to the proto-Egyptians or pre-Egyptians, whatever you want to call them, the Green Saharanites, however you want to label them. And I'm of the opinion that that outcrop of rock, it was the primeval mound in their mind. It was the origins of the Benben stone. As a matter of fact, I made a video on that. It's before I really scripted my videos proper, so I apologize. It's not really as succinct in the parts that it needs to. It's more a little rambly like I'm doing right now. I do that a little bit still, but I try to give you the data now all concise, right? So anyway, we'll continue that way. I'll try to give you some concise data now that I've babbled for a minute. If the outcrop of rock was venerated, it stands to reason that it would be modified quite often, with chiefs or kings trying to associate themselves with the stone knoll that had come to mean so much. After all, if my belief is correct, the Egyptians would have considered this the original place of creation, not just a minor one. This is a place imbued with the power of the cosmos, connecting water and earth and sky. I believe that the original Benben stone was probably a piece taken from that outcrop of rock, like maybe there was a little pointy bit that was aligned perfectly with the sun that somebody had carved, and then somebody later knocks that off and you ended up with a pointy bit. I'm of the opinion that that's where the Benben stone most likely came from. Lots of people believe it was a meteorite, and so that's a very good possibility too, because meteorites do shape themselves like that quite frequently, and the Egyptians definitely worshipped sky iron, so that's a possibility. But the fact of the matter is the power of this place came from its connection with the sun and its connection with the water and its connection with the idea of creation. But what would happen if those connections became broken? Now, when the Sahara started slowly going from lush and green to the desert that we know today, the water would have stopped reaching the Sphinx. You didn't have to wade to reach anymore. You just walked across the land to reach it. And this potentially would have been very problematic for a belief system based on its connection to water and sky. And so now they have access to the bedrock, but they lack the water around the Sphinx that made it special. So in my opinion, when they next carved the outcrop, they dug an enclosure as well. A pit downhill from natural runoff with the intention of filling that pit with water, once again making their primeval mound work in a spiritual sense. Now, in my opinion, you had a long period of time there where the waters were receding every year. It was getting a little bit different every year. You would have more water sometimes than others, but less over time generally. I think during this time that they were constantly changing the way that this pit was set up to clear out the erosion, to clear out the mud, to change things. Each ruler being small and whatnot. Anyway, my point here is that I don't think we're going to be able to suss the exact date of the Sphinx based on the enclosure. I think it's been modified numerous times based on the work of Colin Reeder here and a little extrapolation. It seems to me it was most likely that this site was used, like I say, as a place that they would funnel the water into it. And so they're trying like all they can to keep putting water in the site, but eventually you just can't. Eventually there's not enough water. Eventually, it's once every 2 or 3 years that you get a flash flood that properly fills it and evaporates away in a couple of weeks, and it's right back to being an outcrop, and then it wasn't venerated so much. Then it was kind of forgotten about until Khufu's time, and maybe he starts being the first one to build on the Giza Plateau that we know of in any meaningful sense, and say he stumbled across the Sphinx and just kind of left it there because Khafre is the one that said to have excavated it, if that's what the stela implies. So Khufu sees it or doesn't and leaves it. Khafre digs it out, excavates it, but he doesn't recognize the significance, and neither did Khufu, because Khufu put a pit between the one way that water could get there and the enclosure, forever isolating the Sphinx enclosure from what its original purpose was, according to me. Now, this makes sense if you consider the 4th Dynasty was very much into large construction projects and Zep-Tepi, the first time of Egyptian creation mythology. And it also makes sense if you look at the Osirion. This incorporation of land and water in order to emulate their myths is not something that the Egyptians were not known to do. And, of course, the Osirion happens to be one of those sites that is a little enigmatic, and people tend to question just how old it actually is. Now, Colin Reeder believes that the Sphinx area was venerated much less further back in history than I do. But the reasons that he states that stem from the same ideas that I have, and actually, like I say here, flesh it out. To me, I don't believe that the Egyptians used the pyramids as tombs, but I do believe that they were used as part of a resurrection-like system. As I've said before, I do think, and I'm 100% certain that I got several facts wrong there, but in that video, but I do believe that the basic idea there is most likely right. I do think that their system of numerous gates, numerous stations that one had to pass through on the afterlife, I do think that that was emulated on the earth for powerful people like the pharaohs, and that the three pyramids on the Giza Plateau were key and instrumental features of that. And I believe that the fact that the Sphinx was venerated as the original place of the first time, in my opinion, is the reason that that was the place of resurrection. That's why you see Leo the lion emulated in the Sphinx. I think that they're nodding to their version of Zeptepi. They believe that that was the first time when Leo the lion was there. I think that the three stars in Orion's belt certainly are emulated by the three pyramids, considering that Orion was Osiris, the constellation was Osiris, and Osiris was the god of the underworld. He was the god, he was basically the sun god as he took you through the underworld. So, again, very key with resurrection. And there are reasons to believe that their pyramids were used, but not used as tombs per se. And I've gone into this sort of evidence before quickly. I mean, you can point out that the portcullis doors in the Great Pyramid look like they were made to be opened and closed again. Thanks to History for Granite for pointing that one out. Other things that you could look at is the fact that when they do find the one sarcophagus they found in a pyramid that was sealed, had no body inside, it would make sense that these are symbolic places. They would take them and put the body in for a day, a week, a month, then take the body out and move it somewhere else to its eventual resting place. This, to me, makes more sense than it just being a tomb and a tomb alone. And this would also explain why Sneferu made three and yada, yada, yada. These were important parts for the whole resurrection apparatus. That's my personal belief. Now, of course, this is just my opinion and, you know, just some guy, right? But Colin Reeder, he's not just some guy. He is a geologist, but he is forced to defend his work against Egyptologists. Guess who? Guess who? Zahi Hawass and Mark Lehner. Of course, Zahi Hawass and Mark Lehner. And, well, they don't have any geologists that they're having help them out here. So they make some pretty half-baked arguments, according to Colin. And as a matter of fact, he kind of picks on them a little bit. And to quote the man, when presenting their criticism, Lehner and Hawass refer to only one of a number of articles published by this author on the subject. The article that Lehner and Hawass cite was an exploration of the iconography of the Sphinx and did not address geological issues in detail. This apparent lack of familiarity with the full range of published material may explain why, on a number of occasions in their rebuttal, Lehner and Hawass suggested that certain issues have been ignored. This reminds me of a certain professor that I covered recently that's too fucking lazy to do proper research, but hell-bent on combating pseudoscience, so he misinforms his entire audience drastically and heavily, but it doesn't matter to him because, you know, he got to make sure and get his words out there. This is, as long as people like this are basically gatekeeping what the information is that's allowed to be properly evaluated by their scientific peers, we're going to be decades behind, just like we were with Clovis first. We're going to be decades behind where the data should be bringing us as long as this shit continues. And this has always been a problem, but it seems to be extremely pronounced right now, or at the very least, it's very visible and therefore something that can be combated. So this is, we've got the same usual suspects every time. It's always the same damn guys, right? It, depending on what you're talking about, you're always going to bump into the same issues. And in Egyptology, the guys you're going to bump into are Mark Lehner and Zahi Hawass. Well, thank you so much for watching. I really appreciate it. If you find this kind of content interesting, or you like to hear me yell at people who yell at me, click buttons down below. Have a good day. We'll see you next time.